Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another fascinating show we have for you here on Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I am joined again by our ever-popular co-host, Starina. She is back for another Friday night extravaganza because we have a great show for you tonight. Tonight, we are going to have authors Jocelyn Drake and Stephen White on the phone for you. We are also going to have a little bit here of a smackdown that's going to be the most haunting serial killer kind of in its time. So we're going to pit Jack the Ripper against the Zodiac Killer, both killers that have unsolved mysteries that had hauntings for their time. So it's going to be a wonderful show. Stick around here because 60 minutes of Suspense Radio starts now. Oh, what a fabulous Friday night, everybody. It is going to be a wonderful show for you. And I just want to, again, thank Starina for taking the time out here for joining us on this another Friday night. Matt is off, so Star has come back for the Star-Studded Show. So, Star, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great. And it's always good to be here, as usual. Second time on the show. You're not sick of me yet?
You know, I'm not sick of you yet. It takes a little while for that to happen, and it's going to be a great show. I'm telling you, I'm excited. This is going to be one of those shows that people are going to talk about for a while, not to mention, I mean, I'm just so excited, not just because of the show, too, but because after the show, I get to go with my 13-year-old daughter, Ryan, and we are going to go and go see Great White in concert. So that's going to be fabulous, too. So we're going to have a lot of fun doing that. So I'll tell you what, do you have anything that you want to, let's just jump right in here for book reviews. What do you have that you want to talk about?
John, I do. I have a couple here. The first one I found quite entertaining and interesting is Mark Sadler's Blood on His Hands. That one was more, it's a predator versus a prey. And it kind of straddles the line between a dark thriller and an in-your-face horror. Definitely not something that would be for the faint of heart, but a great, great read. So that's something I would definitely pick up. The other one is John Grisham's, his Theodore Boone Kid Lawyer, which is a children's book, which I found also entertaining, very good. Theodore Boone, he's raised in a law firm, Boone and Boone. Perhaps that's why I kind of like it, because I'm in the legal field myself by day.
We won't hold that against you, though. We will not hold that against you.
I'm not a lawyer, though. Does that help?
Okay. Well, you know, I guess.
But John Grisham, Theodore Boone, Kid Lawyer, that's another great one. It's very exhilarating. It's just something that the children would love. It's amazing. It's actually the first one I've read by John Grisham, so I applaud it. So those are two of mine that I have. And, gee, John, don't tell me. You probably have, what, a trifecta again this week?
Well, no, actually, I only have two again this week. I'm just going to go ahead, or for the show, I'm just going to go with two. But they're two fabulous books, and I'm going to start off here with one that just came out on July the 27th, and this is by best-selling author J.A. Jantz. Now, people know J.A. Jantz because of her series that they have out here, Beaumont and Brady, and this one is called Fire and Ice, and this goes right along the lines of the last books that she had done here, and it is just a wonderful read. A great addition here to the Beaumont Brady series, and it's Fire and Ice, just hit paperbacks on July the 27th, so you want to make sure you pick that one up. The other one that I have has not hit shelves yet, but it is coming to shelves in paperback, and this book is set to come out on August the 31st. And this is by best-selling author Terry Goodkind, and this is called The Law of Nines. And Terry is another one of those great authors that gets fabulous reviews whenever books come out by him. So this one comes out on August the 31st. You want to make sure that that is definitely on your radar for The Law of Nines by Terry Goodkind. The one thing that we want to do also is I want to go ahead and maybe recap a little of Tuesday's show, because Tuesday's show was fabulous. We had authors Brett King on there doing the Radix, his latest book, and also best-selling author Andrew Gross, who is in his third book of the Ty Hawk series for Reckless. And Andrew Gross might be known better to a lot of people as being one of the writers with James Patterson, who started out doing the Women's Murder Club. He also did The Jester and Lifeguard with James Patterson. But he has four books on his own with Reckless that just came out. So it was a great show. You know, they were fascinating guests.
Fabulous show. Really great show.
Yeah, so I mean, they just keep getting, you know, they just keep getting better and better. We just keep getting, you know, the guests are just great. The interaction between the chat rooms and, you know, either people calling in, it's just been a phenomenal effort that we've done here. I think we're on our seventh show, and it's just starting to climb up the charts, and we're really excited about that. But the other thing that we're really excited about, and I want to make sure everybody knows this, is that our August issue of Suspense Magazine has just printed. We have it in our hands. We have sent it out to the subscribers. So if you have not subscribed, you're missing out on an issue that is action-packed, beautiful-looking magazine.
It's fabulous. I have my copy actually sitting right in front of me. And I'm telling you, John, you guys have went all out. I mean, it's great. It's in full color. And those who have not gotten their subscription in, I would do so. It's really a great magazine, packed with just all kinds of stories and highlights of debut authors, up-and-coming ones. It's great. I can't say enough good things about it.
Well, you know, we do call ourselves the inside source for suspense, mystery, thriller, horror, and we're trying to make sure that that's what we do. I mean, there's so many things to cover in that genre. I mean, we really went all out. And it's the other thing that we've done to try to maybe help, you know, the magazine and try to bring, you know, more people here to the table in this genre that is wonderful genre that I love, is we have a quarterly magazine or quarterly newspaper that goes out. It goes to libraries. We send it to coffee shops. We send it out. It's free. It's like an advertising supplement to the magazine. We call it Suspense Times. It's in newspaper form, so it's really easy to read. You pick it up. I think it's 12 pages. And you can just go right through it. It's maybe like a best of what we had in the magazine, a couple things that we couldn't fit in the magazine that are in there. And you can find that, you know, if you just go to local libraries. We're trying to get it all over the country. It's a daunting task, I will tell you that. But it is one of those labors of love that once you see it, it's fabulous. So I'm going to go ahead also, I want to let everybody know, if you want to call into tonight's show and talk with either of the guests, Jocelyn Drake is going to be first. We're going to bring her on here in about a minute. And the phone number is 877-666-9320. So that's 877-666-9320. There's also the chat window is available for people to ask questions at any time they want to. And we get them going on here, and we just have a lot of fun. The 60 minutes seems to just fly by. So I want to go ahead without, you know, skipping a beat. I want to go ahead and right now and bring on our first guest, Jocelyn. So, you know, for a lot of people who might not know Jocelyn, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's great having you as a part of the magazine here and, you know, on Suspense Radio. So why don't you, I know your latest book came out, I believe it was July 29th. Yeah, you kind of had two back-to-back. I think one came out the end of June, and then the other one came out July 29th.
Yes, Pray for Dawn actually came out at the end of June, and then we had Wait for Dusk, which cleared up the cliffhanger that I had left on Pray for Dawn. Wait for Dusk came out at the end of July. So I've had, a quick release recently.
Yeah, just like a month apart, you've been busy.
Yes, very much so.
Now, tell me, Jocelyn, what sparked your interest to write this type of fantasy? I mean, what was it that inspired you to do that? Was it something that you had read as a child, maybe? Or what was it?
Honestly, I had been writing since I was 12 years old. It was anything and everything that crossed my mind hit the page. I didn't, in the early years, worry about genre at all. It was probably about 8 years ago or something like that that I actually started reading what became urban fantasy. I was reading Laurel K. Hamilton and Kim Harrison and Anne Rice and just, you know, anything I could get my hands on that had werewolves and vampires and things like that in it. And something just finally clicked in the back of my head with a certain character, in particular Mira, the main character of my series. And it just, the story just started to unfold, and it was just this beautiful, violent world that just became engulfing of everything I was working on, that I had to stop and actually write what turned out to be a short story. And I thought I was done from there. And I handed the short story off to a friend of mine. I said, here, you know, just check it out and see what you think. And to my surprise, he handed it back to me, and he goes, you're not done yet. It's like, you've got to write a book now.
It's like, I'm not? I mean.
it's like that's how you launch.
Wow, and you have, okay, just a recap for some people who don't know. You have out The Nightwalker. You have Day Hunter, Dawnbreaker, Pray for Dawn, and Wait for Dusk. Those are the last two being the most current. But I see you also have Unbound, which is a novella. You have a novella in there called The Damned and the Forgotten. And that's an actual prequel to The Nightwalker. Wow, that's fabulous. So what order did that one come out? Where was that... Where did that come out? Was it in between Daybreaker and Pray for Dawn, or when did that come out?
I'm trying to think now. I honestly think it was between Day Hunter and Dawnbreaker. I remember distinctly I was just finishing up writing Day Hunter, and it was January 2nd, right after the new year. My agent calls me up, and I'm thinking, she has no business calling me up right now. I'm worried because, you know, we're all set on contracts, everything's good. It's like, why is she calling me? And she gives me this fabulous news. Oh, yeah, you've been invited to be in an anthology. I said, great. There's a little problem. All my books are set very, very closely together in time period. So I couldn't easily stick a short story between what was happening in Day Hunter and Dawnbreak or anything like that. So I actually had to go back and write a prequel to the whole series. And I like that better because I think it gave readers a really good picture of the main character.
Yeah.
Before Danaeus, who's my other main character, came in and really just kind of mucked up her whole world. So it's like you get to see Mira in her natural habitat before the chaos actually starts.
That's actually a really good idea. That was a good idea. Now, in your book, Pray for Dawn, Mira, she is such a strong woman, a strong character. What prompted you to make her a fire-starting vampire? Was it to make her more feared by the others, or what was it?
I think initially when I started writing the Dark Day series and decided to make Mira the fire starter, I needed something that set her apart from the very, very beginning. It wasn't just the fact that she was a vampire. It was the fact that when she was a human, she had this ability, and it carried through. So, I mean, she was a complete anomaly among her own kind, and I wanted her to feel the pressure of not only being an outcast when she was a human, but also being an outcast when she became a vampire among her own kind, so that she's really constantly fighting for that sense of balance and order in her life when the rest of the world really seems to be against her.
Wow. Now, Danaeus, did I say that name right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, Danaeus, he's half human, half vampire, but yet he's the vampire slayer? Is that wrong?
No, actually Danaeus, you find out, technically in the second book, Danaeus is half Bori. That is a race I created that they're essentially the guardians of the soul. They get all of their power from human souls. That's
oh,
where
that's,
they
oh, that's me. That's me, just so you know. That's me. I'm one of those places.
Well,
so,
well
yeah.
they're very
good idea.
They're very tricky characters because they're natural shapeshifters, and they can possess another human. And the story behind Danaeus is he was raised on the idea that his mother sold him when he was still in the womb to what he thought was a demon. So this creature possesses half of his soul. And he was under the impression that if he did something good for the rest of his life, he might actually earn back his soul. So his idea that, you know, vampires are evil and they're the dark, evil, horrible race that are preying on mankind, then if I erase all vampires, then I'll get my soul back. And as the series progresses, he comes to realize that vampires are not the dark, evil thing that he thought they were. So
wow.
He has to suddenly come to terms with the idea that his philosophy of trying to get back his soul and what it means to be losing part of that soul has really, you know, come to fruition throughout the book or the series.
Star, I'm going to jump in real fast because I have a question and I have a comment from the chat room that I just want to, you know, bring out here real fast.
Go right ahead.
One of your fans here is on the chat room and typed, and I'm going to read this verbatim here. It says, I read your book, and you changed my entire outlook on vampire and the various beings, in quote, you write so much about. They just wanted to thank you so much for making it fun to read.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. And so, and then a question that they had was, would you ever consider writing something else? So maybe getting out of that comfort zone and going someplace else.
Like a different genre?
Maybe.
I
mean, I don't think you're gonna jump into maybe kids' picture books. But
I will say I've always drawn the line at young adult. I've toyed with the idea because I had a lot of writer friends who were getting into YA, and it's very hot. It's very, you know, now and where the action is. And I thought about it for a long time, and it's like I've realized that there's too much weight on your shoulders when you're writing YA because you're influencing young minds, you're influencing people,
mm-hmm.
versus when I'm writing adult, it's too late. You're already warped when I get you, so there's no damage that I can do. So I feel free to write whatever the heck I want, and I don't worry about that. For now, as I'm looking out, I'm going to stick with urban fantasy. It's my home. It's where I feel comfortable. That doesn't mean that I'm going to stick exclusively with vampires. I do have a new series that I'm tentatively working on right now. Vampires take
a large... Oh, give us a scoop, Jocelyn. Give us a scoop.
I can't give any more details because we're literally still like batting things around with my editor.
Don't worry. No one's listening anyway. Just give us a scoop.
Yeah, really?
Come on.
Can you at least tell us, is it outside of the series? Is it its own?
Yes,
it has nothing
world.
To do with Danaeus and Mira.
No, it is completely its own world. On this one, I'm happy to say my plans are to throw the doors completely open. If it exists in mythology, it exists in this world, and it has always existed in this world. So you are just as likely to see a vampire, a leprechaun, or a nymph walking down the street as you are a human. And people
that sounds like Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So,
or Venice, maybe.
Hollywood. Yeah. I cannot wait to see what you come up with.
but that's what I'm leaning towards right now. Vampires would exist in this world, but they take a backseat versus the Dark Days series, where they're very much, you know, in the driver's seat on that one.
So you're working on this new idea. Does that mean that this last one that you have out, Wait for Dusk, is there any following that one, or is that the end?
I am contracted for 6 books right now, and
okay.
The 6th book, I don't have a publication date on it. They typically like to release me during the summer, so I'm assuming that it will be summer 2011, and it is titled Burn the Night.
Burn the Night.
Now, just a quick question. I just have a quick question about that then. So do you have any control over your publication date when you say that they like to put me in the summer? Do you have any input in that?
I I've never actually, you know, gone against and say, hey, I'd rather be published at such and such time. It happens a mixture of, I think, when they like to release me and a mixture of also how long it takes me to write the books at this point and get them to just get them delivered. We just ended up on this kind of schedule over the last few books. So, and it works for me. There's a lot of popular urban fantasy that comes out during the summer, so I'm just kind of riding the wave with everyone else.
Now, you said that Mira and Danaeus are definitely not in this new series that you're thinking of, and I know you can't go into a lot, but will any of your characters from this series follow over into the new?
Oh, you guys are trying to weasel such information out of me.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
All
right, yeah, tell us everything you can.
Let's get down to brass tacks then. Okay.
Here we
okay.
go. I literally just heard you shift in your seat, and you're just like, all right, let's get into it now.
Yeah.
The new series has been tentatively agreed upon. Does not exist in Mira's world. There will be no crossover whatsoever. It is a completely different and new launch. Now, that is not to say that I don't have in my back pocket a potential spinoff series that might have cameos of characters that appeared in Mira's Dark Days series. But that has not been officially agreed upon yet. Let's just say that if you love the Dark Days series, I'm willing to fight for you guys to get you more books.
I think a lot of your fans probably would. Now, Mira, you've made her react very humanly to a lot of things, in particular, the death of those she loves. Did you make her that way on the most basic level, on purpose, or did she kind of evolve and kind of dictate it to you?
I think it's a mixture of both. She started out when I started the series. She's 600 years old. And her only attachment to humanity anymore are her two bodyguards, Michael and Gabriel. And it's this constant attachment that she grows with certain characters that maintains that humanity. So as the series progresses, we do see some very violent and horrible deaths, particularly in the last two books. And you see the start of Mira's support levels starting to get knocked out. So you definitely get that very human response. I think one of the big things with me when I wrote Mira is I had to define what she wanted most in life. And what she wants most is she wants a family. She wants to have this normal family. And two of the characters that were kind of the center and core of what she was trying to form were taken away from her. So you get that very human response.
Okay, we've got actually.
Jocelyn, I have a couple chat questions here for you again from your fans out there. So here's question one, and I don't know. I think they might be now. This is not from me, so you can't say I'm trying to weasel information out of you. But
I'll be good. I'm sorry.
Will Mira and Danaeus have a child, and will it be a vampire?
Why do I know who this person is? I have a good suspicion as to who this person is.
And then the other one, just so you know, will you be touring it all this year?
Will I be touring it all? Okay, first one, no. Mira and Danaeus are not going to have children.
This was
an idea that a friend and I, just being sick and twisted, were batting around as to how something like that could be possible at all. And we found a way in a twisted sixth sense of how to do it. But I immediately said, no, we're not going down that road. That would just be horrible. So we're not going down that road in the series. Touring, I'm kind of toured out at the moment. I did three conferences and another book signing, and there are no plans at the moment, particularly with the next. I've got revisions on book six, Burn the Night, coming in right now. And then I also have what could potentially be two or three books that need to be written in relatively quick succession. So I'm probably staying home for now, for at least for the rest of the year.
That wouldn't be a bad idea. Hopefully you'll get a little rest in there. But I have another question for the chat room. Will Mira...
Hello?
Oh, are you there?
Yeah, I just dropped off for a second, I think.
Oh,
I didn't
okay.
hear the question.
Hold on.
Question. Will Mira ever be the head of a coven?
Let's just wait and see what happens in Burn the Night. I can't even give any hints right now. Some things changed unexpectedly on me between writing the book and handing it in, that I honestly don't know what's going to happen completely in the book yet as to where characters are going to end up and, you know, what's going to happen. So it's kind of a wait-and-see moment. Honestly, I don't think she wants it. Even if she had the opportunity, I don't think she wants it. But she could surprise me. I have to admit, when I wrote Day Hunter, I was not expecting her to take the open seat when she did. When I wrote
wow.
that scene, it's like, wow. It's like, I wasn't expecting you to do this. This could have some really bad
repercussions
huh? later. But I let it go, and we've got what we've got right now.
Wow. Now, have you – here's a question that has nothing to do with the books that you've writing or are going to write. So have you ever thought about or considered co-authoring a book? And if you thought about it, what author – actually intrigues you so much that you would consider writing with them?
Oh, wow. I have a lot of authors out there that I think are absolutely fabulous. I love their writing style. Just to name a few are Kim Harrison and Rachel Vincent and Vicki Pedersen and particularly Richard Kadrey. I just finished his Sandman Slim recently, and it was mind-blowing. And the opportunity to work with them would be outstanding, but as a good friend once said to me, it's like, I don't play well with others. When I have my world, when I have my story, I like to have it my way. I don't think I could share with somebody else. I don't
think
you have
your own style
capacity.
And, yeah.
Yeah,
wow.
It's like you see a story going a very particular way, and the only person that's willing to butt in at this point is my editor. And I trust her enough to make the story better. It's not that I wouldn't trust these other authors, but, you know, it just...
Unless they messed with your... Yeah. Yeah.
I'd be willing to share them.
You can't give up that control.
Exactly. No. Apparently, I'm just a big control freak.
Nothing wrong with that. Is there any kind of research that you did for the series, or is it just things that kind of twirl around in your head and they come out as you think of them?
For the series itself, when it comes to the vampires and all the characters and the world, it's very much off the top of my head, you know, just my imagination running absolutely wild. And that's that. The research does come in when I do the setting. Honest to you, I've never been to London. I've never been to Venice, Budapest, Peru, and Egypt. And those are locations for the five books so far. But I have to be able to write them in such a way that I sound like I've walked down these streets before. Almost every place that's mentioned in these books are real places that I have seen pictures of, that I've researched on the internet and through different guides. So that's
Google,
a lot
right.
of hours.
Yeah, it is.
Google is a fabulous thing, particularly
oh, it is.
Google Image.
It is.
Get the picture of, you know, the you'd be surprised by the different islands in Venice. Each one has its own style, its own tone of color. And I had to be able to get that down. Even though I'm writing, you know, nighttime scenes, it's still you have to get that flavor for each of the different islands when Mira's traveling around.
Yeah. Now, I want to let everybody out there know that you can find out more about Jocelyn and her novels. Just go to www.jocelyndrake.com, and that's spelled J-O-C-E-L-Y-N-N-D-R-A-K-E.com. So I think right now John's going to get ready to bring on Stephen White. And Jocelyn, I want to thank you for humoring me and answering some of my idiotic questions.
Oh, no, it's fabulous. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you are so welcome. We are glad to have you. But stick around because
we're
going to
be back
part of
there.
The
yeah,
Suspense
we're
Smackdown.
Back.
Yeah, we're
okay.
bringing you back. So don't go anywhere.
We'll be right back. So,
thank you.
All right. So that was, we want to thank Jocelyn for being a great guest for us here. And I want to just segue right into our next guest. Our next guest here, his book, it's called The Last Lie. It just came out August the 17th, and we are pleased to have the author, Stephen White, with us right now. Stephen, how are you doing? And thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm doing fine, John. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I want to jump in a little bit here because your book, The Last Lie, like I said, just came out on August the 17th, and people can find out more information about Stephen by going to authorstephenwhite.com. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N, white.com. So that's authorstephenwhite.com. So you are a, are you still a practicing psychologist?
You know, being a psychologist is kind of like being a Catholic. No matter whether you stop practicing or not, you still remain one. But I closed my clinical practice over 10 years ago. So I'm technically not practicing any longer.
Okay, but what you do is you draw a lot of your background and a lot of your experience here into your character, Alan Gregory. And what I find fascinating is that when people of those professions and yourself do that, it makes the character much more believable. And, you know, do you feel the same way when, you know, when you're writing Alan?
You know, when I started writing the manuscript that became the first book, I wrote about what I knew, which was about a relatively young clinical psychologist practicing in Boulder, Colorado. And it developed into a long series, but it was based in a foundation of experience that I had. And I hope I bring something special to that part of psychological fiction and psychological suspense fiction.
Yeah, I mean, you have been writing here. Your first book came out, Privileged Information, back in 1991. So you're going on 20 years now writing. What do you think has changed from that first book until now with your writing?
You know, I'd like to think I don't imagine that I'm any different from any other writer in this way. I'd like to think I'm getting better over time. I used to believe as a young writer that writing books was not very difficult. And one of the strange awarenesses that I've had over the years is that the longer I do this, the more difficult it becomes. The standards I have for myself are higher with each book. The expectations I have for myself in terms of writing quality, in terms of character, in terms of story, get higher with each book. So, you know, I think the thing that's changed most over the years for me is my awareness of the underlying difficulty of doing this for a living.
And I think I hear that from a lot of authors. I don't know if it's exactly pressure that you feel, but I guess there is always a sense of pressure to try to make your next book bigger than your last book, or, you know, at least on the same par with, you know, with your last book. But you know, your last book, and you kind of changed, which was called The Siege, and you wrote about a detective called, you know, Sam Purdy. What made you kind of get a little bit, you know, bring some of that in, and, you know, as far as like Alan and things like that, and kind of changing over a little bit?
Over the years, the book that is coming out this week, The Last Lie, is my 18th. And although the books are part of a series, each one is more or less part of that series. And many of them do feature the psychologist character in Boulder, Alan Gregory, and a continuing ensemble of characters who are around him. But occasionally some of the books do feature some of the members of the ensemble, and Alan becomes a secondary character. Last year's book, The Siege, which is just out in paperback, featured one of the secondary characters in the ensemble, and that's Boulder Police Detective Sam Purdy. And I do that primarily because telling certain stories just requires that I not focus the narrative energy on this psychologist in Boulder.
Well, Stephen, I have a question from... I'm sorry, John, I'm going to interrupt here.
Yep.
I have a question from the chat room for Stephen. In Privileged Information in 1991, you had a psychiatrist who feared his patient is a killer who will strike again. Did you have that experience in your practice? And if so, were you able to help him or at the very least warn the authorities?
The idea for the first book actually came from work I was doing as a young psychologist for the ethics board, the state ethics board of the Colorado Psychological Association. And it had to do with a technical question in mental health fields for psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers. Without trying to get too complicated, it's something called the Tarasoff problem. And Tarasoff was a California...
Thank you for calling Suspense Radio.
Uh-oh.
What is your name?
Sorry, you're still on the radio. You clicked the wrong button.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, Stephen. We had little technical things. Are you there? Stephen?
Hello?
Yeah, you
Hello?
There? Yeah. It's the internet. We had a little bit of technical issues, but we're back. We're good. We're all good here. So, kind of going back, I guess, a little bit when, you know, like you have had, you know, 20 years of experience, and I'm sure you brought in a lot of, you know, your practice and maybe some of the things that you heard or you were around and things like that. What's kind of the thing when you write that you just kind of, you know what, I'm not going to go there with my writing because it's just either too dark or just too scary for you to even consider doing something like that?
There are very few things that over the years I've refused to write about. You know, there are things that I've told myself that I'm never going to write about that, and many of them over the years I've probably ended up writing about. So I try and let my creative process take me wherever it's going to take me. You know, certain topics don't interest me very much as a novelist, and I've never written a book, for instance, about child abuse, and I consider that much too dark. And the process of writing a novel keeps me focused for 6 months to a year, and I can't imagine, to be real honest, having to think about a story that's very dark in an area that makes me uncomfortable, like child abuse, for that amount of time. But otherwise, I will follow my creative muse wherever it takes me. I'm grateful for it, actually.
And that's one of the, you know, and that is a great thing that, you know, a lot of, you know, authors can do is kind of try to put, you know, as much as I guess themselves and their real life into their work, which makes it, you know, that just that much more, you know, believable. And I guess you want to say, you know, scary to the audience. And so for people that might not have picked up your, you know, your book, which book would you say of yours would you say, okay, I want you to pick this one up first because this is probably the one that might represent me, not really the best, but this is the one that you're going to get a great sense of maybe who I am and kind of what I write?
When I'm asked that question, it's always difficult. You know, if I think you ask any writer to pick amongst their books, it's like asking a parent to pick, you know, from among their children. But I think if someone was totally unfamiliar with my work, I would ask them to go back about three or four books and pick up a book called Kill Me. And they would get a very good sense of my narrative sensibilities as a storyteller and the way I think about the novel form.
So, yeah, and I know that is a very difficult question for you to... you know, answer, and it is a lot of, you know, difficult questions, but can someone go and say, okay, pick up, go ahead with Alan Gregory and just kind of start maybe, you know, maybe not at the beginning, but maybe kind of in the middle and still be able to kind of then go back to the beginning and pick things up? Is that something they could do?
One of the things that I work very hard on when I'm writing is to make sure that each book in the series stands alone, that if someone is completely unfamiliar with my background and with previous books in the series, they can pick up any story and find that it's a complete book with completely developed characters. The only thing that would differentiate a longtime reader from a new reader is that the longtime reader would know some backstory on the characters, you know, who married who divorced who's friends with who, in more detail than a current reader would. But each book stands alone, and each book is a complete event for a new reader. They should not have any problem knowing exactly what's going on.
Well, if you don't mind taking a call, we have a phone caller here. We have Brett from Colorado who wants to ask you a question. So, Brett, thank you so much for calling the show, and you are on with Stephen White. Go ahead.
Hey, all right. This is Brett King. Stephen, we met about 14 years ago. I'm another Colorado psychologist, and you were a terrific influence starting out. And you told me, one of my favorite books of all time of yours was Higher Authority. It's still one of my favorites because it was such a bold book. And I think I remember you saying that it was the only book that your publisher ever had to consult the legal department about. Was there ever any fallout from that particular book?
Well, hello, Brett. I do remember you. It's good to hear your voice again. I'd like to say that it's actually still true that Higher Authority is the only book that I've written that forced my publisher to consult a lawyer, but the book that's coming out on the 17th of August, The Last Lie, required vetting by three different lawyers, so I now have two of them.
Wow.
there turned out not to be any legal fallout from Higher Authority, and I hope I can say that the same will be true for The Last Lie. It's got its own controversy in terms of legal issues, and the lawyers have told me I'm on safe ground, and I hope they're right.
All right, Brett, thank you so much for calling in. It's great to hear your voice again, as we heard you there on Tuesday. That was great. So I want to just remind everybody here that, you know, the phone number to call in is 877-666-9320. We are chatting right now with New York Times bestselling author Stephen White, and we are talking about his book, The Last Lie, which comes out on August the 17th to every place, everywhere, and it's definitely a book that you want to go check out. But I want to take you back again just a little bit, because I love to ask this question of authors, because I kind of find it fascinating, and I think a lot of maybe up-and-coming authors who are trying to get going kind of like to hear the story is, when you first found out that you were going to be published, you know, with your book, Privileged Information, how did you celebrate? What did you do?
These stories, yeah, I love to hear them too. I love to hear from other writers how they you know, found a publisher and what that first day was like. For me, I have a pretty unusual story about selling that first book. I was unable to find an agent for well over a year. Despite the fact that I was doing something just about every day to try and get my manuscript read by someone in New York City. And I ended up getting a junior editor at Viking to read the book through a friend of my oldest brother. And he read it and apparently liked it, but wasn't buying fiction at the time. He was buying nonfiction, and sent it upstairs to the editor-in-chief for what he called further consideration. I was growing pretty skeptical of ever breaking into publishing at that time, and I was pretty sure that what was upstairs at Viking Penguin was the mailroom, and that I was going to get the manuscript back soon enough. About 2 weeks later, I got a phone call. It was on April 2nd in 1990. And a very kind man named Al Silverman said, "My name is Al Silverman, I'm with Viking Penguin, and we want to buy your book." And my immediate reaction was, this is a late April Fool's Day joke from my friend, who knew how desperate I was to try and sell this book. And I had this very pleasant conversation with Al Silverman, who is a delightful human being and still a terrific friend of mine. And we hung up the phone, and I realized I had not gotten his phone number. And I had no way to call him back. And so my first few hours after finding out that I had indeed sold my book were in abject panic that I had no way to reach this kind man who had offered to buy it.
And this was probably before caller ID and, of course, the internet. And you're just like, what do I do?
Oh, no. I have a caller, or excuse me, not a caller, but I have a question from the chat room for you. They're asking, how did it feel to have your brother Richard as a Pulitzer Prize finalist? Is that award something you would like to receive, or is it writing its own reward for you?
My oldest brother Richard is, I'm certainly not the only writer in my family, and I'm not the best writer in my family. My oldest brother Richard is a celebrated historian, and one of his recent books was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. Richard and I fortunately don't compete as writers. He writes nonfiction and writes it beautifully, and I write fiction, and you know, I'll let other people judge how well I write it. So Richard and I have nothing more than mutual respect for each other's work. That's probably not true. I probably respect Richard's work more than he respects mine. But it's a joy to have another writer in the family. It's a joy whenever there's someone who has some sense of the struggles involved in doing this work.
And that's what it is. I mean, there's always a struggle, you know, whether or not it's your first or, you know, your 19th, there's always that struggle that comes out. And at least it doesn't make for awkward Thanksgiving dinners, which is also, you know, very important too. So the other, we kind of had, you know, this question that came up for Jocelyn, but do you do a lot of touring for your books? Do you go out to go out there and tour it a lot?
When I was young, I toured with every book. And, you know, you asked a little earlier, John, what has changed in this business? And
one of
the things that's changed dramatically in crime fiction publishing is the number of writers who are on the road. And in the old days, everybody went on the road for just about every book. And now it's becoming much less frequent for writers to tour and certainly for publishers to fund touring. So I've not done a major tour, the, you know, 20 cities in 30 days tour, for probably 5 or 6 years. And for The Last Lie, I will be doing only events in Colorado where I live. And that's becoming pretty standard in the industry right now, is that fewer and fewer writers are traveling nationally.
And do you think that has to do because more authors, you have to almost have a good marketing background now to be able to market yourself, which is extremely important, than just sitting back and letting your publisher kind of market it for you and saying this is where you're going to go and then just go do it?
I think there's a lot of value in terms of staying in touch with readers and meeting fans, and I miss that part of being on the road. I think what's more a problem is how cost ineffective it is. It's very expensive to mount the tours, and I think the publishers ultimately came to a decision that the touring did not sell enough books to make up for the marketing costs. And I think publishers more and more are relying on the sorts of things you're doing to get the word out to readers and to fans about books, relying on shows like this one and on the internet and on social media to get conversations started on the internet about authors and new books and new releases. So I think what used to be done face-to-face in bookstores is now being done, you know, through people like you.
And you know, that's really one of the main reasons why we started the magazine, was just because we wanted to reach out to as many fans as we could to help out authors like yourself and, you know, and also help out readers and fans to make better, new, you know, informed decisions about, you know, who to read and who's out there and who's new and, you know, what they have writing. So I think it's great. And so, You know, Stephen, I want to thank you so much for coming on with us tonight. I want everybody to pick up The Last Lie on August the 17th in bookstores everywhere. And it's also going to be, of course, on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com and other outlets where you can find books online. And you can find more information out by visiting Stephen's website at authorstephenwhite.com. And that's S-T-E-P-H-E-N is how you spell Stephen's name. So, Stephen, I want to thank you so much for the interview, and I'm going to go ahead and we're just going to jump right in here to the SmackDown part of our segment, and it's time.
I'm already giving you instruction in the dressing room. I expect a tough, clean fight. Protect yourself at all times. Request from the challenger.
So here we come to our SmackDown segment where we have Jocelyn back on the phone and we have Steven and Star, and we are going to debate tonight the hauntingness. I'm not really sure what word. I like to make up words like humongous and haunting, and so I'm just going to make up my own word. Which unsolved serial killer is probably the one that is either the most haunting or just the one of the scariest ones of their time? So we're going to go with the Whitechapel Jack the Ripper here against the Northern Central California, I believe in the 60s, the Zodiac Killer. So, Jocelyn, I'm going to go to you. Which one do you think is probably the most haunted or the most feared, maybe unsolved serial killer out there?
Okay. Well, I have to make a small admission in the fact that my experience or my knowledge about these two killers comes purely from movies. Which, you know, is always sketchy to begin with.
True. I wasn't alive in the 60s either, but I'm just, you know, just from reading and movies too.
But I didn't do any kind of reading research. You know, if you'd warned me ahead of time, I would have, you know, boned up on the subject. But
that's okay.
That's the fun of it.
The one that
really appeals to me, I guess maybe I'm just sick and twisted, is Jack the Ripper. I come from a background, I've got a literary background, you know, other than the vampires, and I love the old Victorian stories of Frankenstein, Jekyll and Hyde, Dorian Gray. It's that old world mystery that appeals to me. I guess when you come into more present day killers, it becomes almost mundane. This is on the news every day. You hear it all the time. But there's such an enigmatic thrill behind Jack the Ripper. He's mysterious. He's dark. He could have been anyone. I don't know. It's just a little chill up my spine, and the fact that, you know, it was just so almost magical back then.
Steven?
It's the same now.
Steven, which one do you kind of think? And I know that a lot of it has to do with either research or seeing or hearing books and things like that, because none of us were alive when, of course, Jack the Ripper was going on. But who would you think?
Well, because I'm a Berkeley grad and an old-time Berkeley boy, I'm going to go with the hometown and go with the Zodiac Killer.
And fabulous. And Star?
You know, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go with Jack the Ripper. Yeah,
of course, you know, why not?
Either.
And the women are going to stick together because, you know, the women are going to stick together. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to go.
We know what we're talking about.
Well, that's for another show. I'm going to go with the Zodiac Killer, and I'm going to go with the Zodiac Killer on this front just because. Jack the Ripper was one who preyed on, I guess you want to say, the very lower class prostitutes of Whitechapel, and I know that it was a time when that was not going on. And I love the Jack the Ripper story, and I hope it never gets solved because I think it's one of those things that should never get solved. So the Zodiac Killer, to me, I think, kind of stretches a little bit further because, right, he was not only was he in the United States, but it was a time with a little more population, and there was really no rhyme or reason to who he was going to go after. But like both killers, they just stopped immediately. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a wean off or anything. It was just an immediate stop. And I think that the time of the Zodiac was when it was like, what the heck is going on? And everybody was kind of scared to death. And Stephen, you being from Berkeley, you might have heard the stories because, of course, it was up in that San Francisco, and I think it was even down in the Bakersfield. So,
yes.
Yeah, so that's why I think, you know, the Zodiac Killer, and I still haven't found a good movie about Jack the Ripper yet anyway. I still think that you should read the books to find out more, because when they try to do Jack the Ripper, they just, I don't think they actually hit the nail on the head. So I'm going Zodiac Killer tonight.
There's just, you know, Jack the Ripper, there's, you know, of course, all the stories running around, just like with any of them, but, you know, they don't even know it, really, if he killed, you know, prostitutes, if he killed, well, he killed the prostitutes, but did, were there five victims? Were there nine victims? You know, the story goes back and forth. Some even claim that there was actually 13 other women murdered in the East End in that time period, but they don't think that they were victims of the Ripper.
Technically, I've heard that it could be upwards of 40.
Yeah, I mean, the story changes. Depends on who's telling it and how many times you hear it. So, you know, we don't know. We'll never know.
And I think that that's the fascinating point, is we won't know and we don't and we'll never know. And it's always a good thing to talk about, you know, kind of a debate back and forth of just, you know, who was he or whatnot. And I, you know, just one of those exciting times. Well, I guess I shouldn't say exciting times, but, you know, there's always some kind of, like, excitement that goes on, especially, you know, with any kind of serial killer. I mean, whether it was John Wayne Gacy or Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy, I mean, the list goes on and on. So,
yeah. And we don't know why these people stopped killing all of a sudden. Was it because they were jailed on another crime? Did they, you know, get killed themselves? Or,
like Jocelyn, did they find their soul and then they just moved on?
There you go.
Right? Huh? That's what I'm talking about. So, well, I'll tell you what, I'm, you know, Stephen and I, unfortunately, I think we're going to lose this one because I believe Jack the Ripper is the chat room favorite, but that's not the last time that I'm sure that the men will lose to the women.
No, it's not the last time. Get used to it.
But I want to thank, I'll tell you what, there's only about 3 or so minutes left, so I want to go ahead and I want to thank everybody so much, Stephen and Jocelyn, for being on. I'm going to go ahead again. Stephen White's book, The Last Lie, August the 17th, authorstephenwhite.com to find out more information about Stephen. So thank you so much for coming on, Stephen. And
thank you, Stephen.
It was my pleasure. Star, thank you. It was great.
Yeah, Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you both on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and so everyone, pick up Jocelyn Drake. You have to go see Jocelyn Drake. You heard her on the air. You know what kind of writer she is. She is a fabulous writer. Star, give out her website again.
It is www.jocelyndrake.com, and it's spelled JocelynDrake.com. So go check her out. I mean, fabulous.
Absolutely. I mean, you don't have that's the great thing that we bring, that we try to bring to you here, is we try to bring a different style each week, where, you know, we had the dark urban fantasy here of Jocelyn, and then we had the, you know, the Alan Gregory stories of Stephen White and the psychologist kind of way, and then now he's going into Sam Purdy. So that's what we try to bring our guests here every week. Two fabulous guests, another great show. I don't know. You know, maybe Star here is, you know, maybe she's good luck charm, so we have to think about that, don't we, Star?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I'll tell you, it's coming down to crunch time here. We only got about a minute left. My daughter is chomping at the bit now to run out the door and go see Great White. So many of you might know who they are. And so we are going to run out there and see that concert as fast as we can. So in honor tonight of the Great White concert that I'm going to go see now, we're going to leave you with this, and we're going to see you all on Tuesday with our next show at 6 p.m. Pacific time right here on Suspense Radio. So, Star, thank you very much, and here we go.
Thank you.